You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is Resonance's weekly show about the world of comics. Today's show starts a month of shows looking at your local comic book shop, a place where people can start and nurture an interest in comics, or find the experience bewildering. And in this episode, we have a trio of interviews in which comic book creators talk about shops. In 2000 AD artist PJ Holden's case, who you'll hear later in the show being interviewed by Matt Badham, he frequented a couple of comic book shops when he was growing up in Belfast. In Doctor Who comic illustrator Al Davison's case, he runs a graphic novels and art supply shop in Coventry, which he takes on tour to various conventions around the country. And in former gay comics writer Will Morgan's case, he is one of the proprietors of a comic book shop in Putney, which in situ specialises in classic British comics. But like Al, when he brings stock to sell at Oxford's Small Press Caption Convention, where this time last year all three of these interviews were recorded, he brings a selection more tailored to the audience which comes along to the event. Before you hear the interviews, which are occasionally interrupted by one of Caption's founders, Jeremy Day, as she looks for people to join her writing workshop at the Comics Festival, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, radio, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
I'm talking to Will from 30th Century Comics in Putney, who's here at the Caption Small Press Festival in Oxford, selling a range of, I guess, mainly alternative comics. Is it that you keep an eye out for some of more the underground stuff in order to sell it at venues like this that perhaps have a different kind of audience to, say, the people who come into your shop in Putney?
Absolutely. We do have a very diverse range of stock at the store because primarily there we specialise in the vintage American and British comics, as I jokingly call it, crumbly old comics for crumbly old people. We're not a shop for the trendy youngsters, but we do have an eye for the alternative, the underground, the indies, always have had. And while there's so much still being published, thank goodness, it's still a very active scene that we can't possibly hope to encompass it all, we do try to be representative.
Because I must admit, some of the titles you've got here, I myself bought an early comic by Philip Bond and Jamie Hewlett off you 10 minutes ago. There are some titles here I just actually wouldn't have known how to get hold of, except maybe through eBay. So actually shops like yours and the store that you take on tour to places like Caption is still a way of getting hold of older alternative titles that perhaps have slipped out of the public consciousness.
Absolutely. We've been very lucky recently in having a selection, not represented here today due to lack of carrying capacity, of the classic American undergrounds as well, which are, they had vanished in these small print runs when they emerged. But more than that, the diversity of stock is important to us because there's a vital range of contributors out there, and it's nice to look back on the roots of some of these people. You mentioned Jamie Hewlett, Phil and Bond earlier, and hopefully have a little something around to see where they came from and embarrass them with at signings.
How many captions have you been to before?
Well, I did take a break for about 5 years, but previously there I was there for about eight. So maybe this is my tenth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so, does anyone fancy drawing a plucky brewmaster teaming up with a barista to kill the giant slugs with salt and coffee grounds?
We've just had a cameo from Jeremy Day, looking for more people to join her workshop. Presumably, having then come to Caption a few times, you get an idea of the kind of comics that sell in this environment. Because I noticed that on the stall here, you've got quite a large selection of gay comics, for example, that are actually particularly hard to get hold of, I've noticed. And I don't know if that's indicative of the mainstream shops, even places like Gosh and Page 45 up north, knowing whether or not they can reach out to the gay and lesbian community. And certainly if you go into Soho, for example, I don't think you see comics in any of the gay bookshops, which seems really bizarre. I mean, how have you sort of noticed that selling
to a gay and lesbian audience is something that you can tap into in events like this?
Absolutely. I've worked Pride a number of times, both in Brighton and in London, and the fact remains that it's one of the mythical grails of comic stores. It's people who don't normally buy comics who will buy comics because of a specialised area of interest. Mm. We've also found that with British comics in the shop, actually, because it's an overlap between... There's no significant overlap between the American and British comics readers. So, again, it's the mythical new money that comic shops are always looking for. But, yes, reaching out to the gay and lesbian community has been very effective. And I will declare a personal interest. 30th Century Comics has always been a 50% owned gay business. Gay-owned business. Let's get the grammar right there. So, yeah. And I used to contribute to titles like Gay Comics and Meat Men myself many years ago under my maiden name of Howard Sangroom before I changed it. So, you know, it's pursuing my own agenda as well to a certain extent, but it has proved very effective.
So have you sold back issues of Gay Comics and then said, actually, would you like me to sign that because I'm one of the contributors?
No, that would be a bit self-aggrandizing. People have asked, but I've never prompted them. It was gratifying, actually, when my old works from the 80s and 90s were collected by Bruno Gamunda a couple of years ago in Prime Cuts. They did a full-colour paperback retrospective, which was kind of fun but kind of creepy because I had these German people stalking me and I didn't know what it was all about. But it's been a modest success and I hope to do a second volume in a year or so's time.
Well, I spoke to the creators of Manly a couple of years ago, which is also published by Bruno G. I'm not going to try and pronounce it myself.
My best guess.
No, it sounded good. And actually, that does seem to be a way that gay comics can sort of disseminate into the wider world is through art bookshops. And it's weird, like we were discussing, that there seem to be different markets. And at the moment, there isn't as much crossover as you might think there could be.
There's probably more closet comics fans than you thought. The first couple of years I worked Pride, people didn't seem to get it. I kept getting people coming up furtively and asking, got any X-Men? So, you know, we are everywhere. But, yes, the, excuse the unfortunate term, penetration of the mainstream market in the larger bookstores has been very gratifying over the last few years. I don't know really how that can be reunited with the comics mainstream, or even if it needs to be. It's enough that there are people out there appreciating the work for its own merits, I think.
But then, like you said, you know, someone might come up to you and guiltily say, have you got any X-Men? But at the same time, people have been saying for the past 30 years that the X-Men is a metaphor for the gay experience. I mean, how true do you actually think that is? Or do you think in a way it's something that the mainstream says in order to sort of be a sop towards gay audiences, when in fact, oh, if they find representation in the X-Men, we don't need to make as many titles for them in general?
I think, without question, the metaphor has always been there, certainly since the 1970s revival, not so much in the original series. But, yes, it has been played upon by the editorial staff, and they've included knowing little self-references within the content of the comic itself, like the mother of a newly discovered mutant saying, well, have you tried not being a mutant, which is a pretty obvious, you know, play on most parents' initial reaction to their kids coming out. But, yeah, it has been used, I think, somewhat as an excuse for not including a more visible diversity in the mainstream. It's significant that most of the gay heroes in the mainstream, they're tokens and they're mostly barely visible. And it's interesting that in the crises or the infinite whatevers, it's usually always those guys that are in the front line, you know, the red shirts on the landing party. Or should I say pink shirts?
Indeed. And then at the other end of the spectrum, I've just noticed on the front of your store you've got some Christian mini comics, which I've never seen before. Could you talk a little about those?
Okay, well, the ones that I use are from the Jack T. Chick Ministries, which possibly it's hypocritical of me, but they're marketed by a few comics dealers on the lines of the Golden Turkey Awards as they relate to fandom, to film fandom. They are so bad that they are strangely compelling because they equate not just homosexuality, but drug addiction, extramarital sex, Catholicism, with being implements of Satan. You know, they are completely out there. And the thing is, this isn't done by one little man running them off in his back bedroom. These are actually done to quite a high professional standard by uncredited minions who doubtless donate their services for the cause. And I've always found the concept of God comics, of religious comics, interesting, because there are the purely didactic ones, like the ones from the Chick Ministry, which are highly accomplished technically and completely barking in terms of the content. But there are also ones like the Spire Christian comics that use the Archie characters from the 1970s, in which you have the squeaky clean Archie gang suddenly going around and preaching on the beach in their bikinis. It's all well-intentioned, but horribly misfiring.
And actually, in terms of talking about crossover audiences, you know, living in London, you see Christian bookshops here and there, particularly in the poorer communities. And I've never actually had the urge to go into one for some bizarre reason. But I wonder if, in fact, they still make Christian comics that you can buy in those venues, and it's another subculture that we just don't hear about.
I do know that the Jack T. Chick tracts, such as I'm displaying here, are still constantly reprinted, and I believe that they're available through Christian bookstores. The Spire Christian comics, unfortunately, the full-colour ones, in the traditional American comics format, petered out around 1981, which is a great shame, because they're rather charmingly bonkers.
One of the reasons for doing Caption at all, I imagine, is so that there is a dialogue between the small press and the mainstream. And indeed, a lot of small press creators go on to become mainstream creators. And this is something that's also displayed on your stall. I hadn't realised, actually, that there were underground comics by Steve Ditko available, for example.
Well, it's not exactly underground, though it's certainly alternative. Steve Ditko has usually been a law unto himself ever since about the 70s or so, but in the late 70s and early 80s he started doing more self-published material in conjunction with a gentleman named Robin Snyder, who published and essentially bankrolled him. And it has a lot more of his incoherently didactic views on social justice and personal responsibility, which is doubtless very compelling reading if you actually have the determination to get through them. They're kind of dense, and I don't mean that in a sense of stupidity. They're just kind of impenetrable. But yes, he's done quite a lot of what could be called independent work, because it's certainly not mainstream, even though he has very far from an underground sensibility.
And then, again, thinking about how your stall might want to appeal to all sorts of different members of the public who could come through the doors today. Kids' comics are represented, for example, by Lockjaw and the Pet Avengers. Do you find that it's kids coming to buy those, or is it actually students?
Lockjaw and the Pet Avengers is the single best comic that was produced by Marvel last year. Scientific fact. It's got, you know, the Inhumans teleporting dog Lockjaw, it's got Lockheed the Dragon from the X-Men, it's got the Frog Thor, Speedball's Bouncing Cat, it's got all the big names teaming up to win back the Infinity Gauntlet. I mean, you know, when the humans, when the bipeds are busy, it's actually a very clever, witty comic that is perfectly readable by younger persons, but it also appeals to adults because of the in-jokes and the self-reference, and it's in the mainstream Marvel universe. It's not, you know, held disdainfully with two fingers and set apart from the main universe like a lot of the kiddie-friendly fairies in the other companies. But yes, it's mostly the kiddies who are drawn to it, and then the adults pick it up and start sniggering and, you know, really get into it.
Cool. Thank you very much.
No problem.
You can find more info about Will Shop, 30th Century Comics, on Lower Richmond Road in Putney at www.30thcentury.free-online.co.uk. That's the word 30thcentury.free-online.co.uk. And his book, Prime Cuts, written under the pseudonym of Howard Strangram, can be bought from Amazon if you can't find a shop that stocks it. Next, here's my interview with Al Davison about his experiences in selling comics.
I'm talking to Al Davison, who's running the other mainstream, for want of a better word, comic stall at Caption. And again, like talking to Will from 30th Century, I guess this in a way is like your Astral Gypsy store from Coventry on tour. Do you find yourself going to lots of comics events around the country in order to find new readers?
Yes, well, mainly we don't have much footfall through the actual physical shop we have, so we need to do as many of the shows as possible to sort of keep the store going. But we do find, obviously, we cater to each show depending on, you know, on what kind of audience it is. So got a lot more independent and small press stuff for this event, obviously.
Well, cause I was going to say, I mean, obviously, on your stall today, I must say it's the largest range of alternate manga I think I've seen in any one place in a long time.
Yeah, we do specialise in trying to present the alternative manga. One of our favourite companies is called Fanfare, who co-publish with a French company called Ponemon. And they do some very interesting alternative and underground manga. Mm. We've also got some American editions of some of the more underground. The guy's called the grandfather of the underground manga. His name, Yoshiro Tatsumi, including his autobiography, which is one of the possibly one of the biggest graphic novel autobiographies I've ever seen. I think it took him about 15 years to produce.
Yeah, I noticed that Drawn and Quarterly have been doing some lovely collections of his work recently. Yes. Do you find that's actually then become a gateway drug, as it were, for people to explore other independent and alternate manga that hasn't really been available in the English language before now?
Yes, definitely. And again, with Fanfare, people who have a certain perception of what manga is, which is seen, you know, the very mainstream, maybe Tokyo Pop style, or think that manga is only, you know, cute-looking characters with big eyes. You know, we like to present them with the alternative. You know, there's as many different art styles in mangas as any other comic. But it's definitely having companies like Drawn and Quarterly and Fanfare producing the more unusual work is really good to see, and it does open doors a lot.
The theme of this year's caption is Mad Science, and you are one of the artists on the American Doctor Who comics, so I guess that's dovetailed very nicely, you being here both as someone selling comics from your shop, but also someone who can contribute Doctor Who art to the caption wall.
Yes, I put a page in that seemed quite appropriate for the theme, an original page from issue 2, I think, which involves some mad alien scientists trying to steal Charlie Chaplin's charisma with some very strange contraptions. So that does work quite well for the theme.
And you've contributed the artwork to the Caption 2010 t-shirt, which you're modelling right now. did they approach you? Did they give you any kind of brief other than it's about mad science?
I actually approached them because I said, okay, I've done quite a lot of different things for Caption over the years, and I've been here from almost from the beginning, but I'd never designed a t-shirt before, so I thought it was about time, so I asked if I could, and they were happy to accept. And no, there was no specific thing other than just, you know, the theme, and then just do what you like.
Having then been coming to Caption for years, have you noticed younger people coming over the years? Have you noticed sort of different generations of comic creators coming and going as they sort of enter the mainstream and start off in the small press?
Well, what I have found is that even creators who have maybe become more mainstream, had more success in the mainstream, still seem to support Caption for a lot of the time. It's certainly true of myself and other people I know that it's such an important event on the calendar in terms of supporting the, you know, the alternative and self-publishing, that I think, you know, people are very, a lot of creators are very keen to remember their roots and keep coming back and supporting.
Like I said, you also run a shop in Coventry. How's that going? Because I know that you had some financial troubles recently. Have you managed to get more interest in the public to visiting that part of the world?
Not so much in terms of coming to the actual shop.
Okay.
It's still a struggle. I think it's generally a struggle getting people to come to Coventry anyway.
Indeed.
You know, it's a shame because it is a, you know, there's a thriving art scene in Coventry and there's lots of interesting things going on. But just we happen to be in an area of Coventry which is perceived to be on the outskirts, on the outside of Coventry, when actually it's only a 5-minute walk from the centre.
Yeah.
So we're still relying on the shows. Yeah. And now I've, at least for now, finished on the Doctor Who work. I'm just looking for other work to try and keep us going and sort of keep the things moving.
Because on the stall here, as in your shop in Coventry, it's indicative of the fact that not only do you sell comics, you sell art supplies. And that seems to be a real ideal combination, selling comics and the materials to create them, and I'm surprised that other shops haven't picked up on that.
Yes, I think some other shops do limited supply, maybe the art papers or anything like that, but we find because, I mean, Coventry's a university town, and there's a fine art and illustration courses running in Coventry, and of course a lot of the people that are into especially manga are also equally into drawing the manga, and we run classes in the shop as well, so it seemed logical that we would start supplying, you know, and similarly with the books, you know, we only supply materials that we like and approve, you know. We don't supply things purely for the commercial point of view. Obviously, if someone asks for something, we'll get it if we can.
Yeah.
But in terms of what we like to present, it's things that we think are worthwhile. So, you know, we only go for what we think are the best quality materials as well as the best quality books.
Well, I think that's something that's really nice about independent shops is that they do reflect the taste and the interests of the owners. I was talking to Will and he was talking about how they stock gay comics and more sort of alternative and underground comics that perhaps you wouldn't come across normally. And so here, like you said, there's a selection of independent manga, there's a selection of comics that perhaps show a more painterly aspect to their creation, so creators like Charles Vess and so on.
Yes, obviously it does reflect our taste, and since I'm from a comics background, my wife isn't, it's more my taste. She's started to get into more, and she does find things that she's now enjoying and does go for, you know. She's a big fan of Jeffrey Brown, and you know, we both like Charles Vess's work, obviously. Neil Gaiman, Alan Moore, Melinda Gebbie, you know, all these people that we really want to support, you know, including Alan's new magazine, Northampton-based magazine, which we're really pleased to see. Yeah, so.
Cool, thank you very much.
For more info about Al's shop, The Astral Gypsy, which is in the Canal Basin, Coventry, and about Al's work in general, please go to www.astralgypsy.com. Finally, in today's show, we have Matt Badham's interview with artist PJ Holden, who's talking about his formative years in Belfast.
John McCrell could probably get mentioned a lot, because John, when I was about 18, and I'd sort of stopped drawing after school, was 18, there was a comic shop opened in Belfast, and it was owned by John McCrell. And when I met John, I started sort of drawing again, and I would bring artwork into him. And eventually, when John started doing stuff for Crisis, I would go round to his house and sit and draw at the same time. And well, he would be drawing, and I would be scribbling and watching Kate Bush videos. So, you know, it was time well spent, I think, I feel. But John was saying he was at a, I can't remember what it was, a sign-in somewhere with Brian Bolland. And Bolland had a Wonder Woman cover, and Brian Bolland was going, oh, look at her leg. It's just rubbish. And you're kind of going, well, you know what, if Brian Bolland feels that about himself, then, you know. I it's very easy, I think, to sit and go, I am rubbish, I am crap, and have that little voice tell you that you're pathetic and you're no use. But I think it is true of every artist. There is not a single artist that doesn't sort of, I think the ones that go, do you know what, I'm actually really good, I am brilliant, they're the same guys that don't draw. They're the guys that have stopped drawing because they kind of, they reach a pinnacle and they think, I am just brilliant now, I don't need to, you know, how can I improve on that? That is, I've reached nirvana, I can get no better, I'll stop now. So those guys don't really improve and often don't even keep drawing. So
It reminds me of another thing that Matt Brooker again Disraeli said, which was he said you've got to achieve a state of functional dissatisfaction, he called it. You're not so dissatisfied with your art that you stop, but you're not so smarmy about it that you just never improve. Let's bring it back to your biography then, and so it's the early 90s. Tell us about the scene in Belfast and your...
Well, there wasn't. I mean, there were two comic shops. There was Dark Horizons, which was a shop John McCrae and a guy called Fred Collier had opened, and it was a little pokey comic shop. And then there was Talisman, which later went on to become the Forbidden Planet, Belfast Forbidden Planet. And there was a bit of bad blood between the two shops, so you'd often find that people shopped in one would not shop in the other. So I was quite happy to go between the two because I, you know, I really didn't care. But I wasn't buying comics from either, so it didn't matter to me. But there seemed to be little groups of people doing comics. But because there was no, you know, the social network at that point was who you would recognise on the street. You know, that was Facebook. And if you, you know, if you didn't know them, you wouldn't know what anyone was doing. So, and comics by its nature is quite solitary anyway. So it's only your immediate circle of friends. I had one friend that, he knew more people than me, but when I was sitting in the house drawing, I saw no one, chatted to no one. There was no one to talk to beyond John McRae. So there might have been an amazingly astonishing comic scene, but I don't honestly think there was. I think Belfast, for whatever reason, didn't really have a... Prior to that, prior to the 90s, there did seem to be a wee small press thing. Guys like Davey Francis, who did stuff for Oink, and Will Simpson, who did Dread, and had all done a magazine called Zimok, which is comics backwards. So they'd done some stuff, but the problem is when that stuff appeared, it disappeared again, and then you never heard about it. It was gone. It was away. There was no kind of history. There didn't seem to be a history, which the internet now allows you to do. And now there's a kind of, there's a couple of artists in Belfast. And for a long time, when John left Belfast, as far as I was aware, I was the only comic artist in Belfast or even in Northern Ireland. You know, the only working comic artist in Northern Ireland. I was it. I kind of think, Jesus, that can't be right. That you know, but there are.
But
a few
now you've
more
got
there.
The eclectic mix, haven't you?
They're all in the south of Ireland.
Oh, right.
I know it seems like it's a strange distinction to make, but there's a different sense of culture in the south of Ireland and Northern Ireland. You know, the council is run by very hard bitten Presbyterians whose idea of art is kind of grey flannel.
Like
it's kind
dad's.
Of no. Well, my dad's different. My dad's he's got middle class Catholic aspirations, which means art for him is all about Ulysses and acting. You know, theatre. That's it. That's what defines art for him, and that's grand. But then there was the Presbyterian tradition, which essentially art is all wasteful. So you know, so there wasn't really. I don't think there was an art scene really that I. But there could have been a brilliant one. I was just completely cut out.
You weren't invited.
I just wasn't invited.
It was a great party. You weren't invited.
Oh God!
So how did you actually start getting stuff into print?
It was the internet, 97, the internet, after university, and I started using the internet. I went back to university to do a degree in computers in 93, so by 97 I had an email address and internet, and I contacted various, Class of 79 by W.R. Logan, which was a Dread fanzine, because I was getting to the point where I felt I wanted to do...
You've been making
again.
A living from
I'd been making my living from computers time. And I'd stopped drawing when I went back to college. I'd stopped drawing in favour of acting, so I was doing some acting and I was working in computers, and then I'd sort of kind of run the acting had run its course for me. I kind of felt that I've done that, and then I kind of decided I really wanted to get back into drawing in 97 and drawing properly and actually get stuff in print. So I sent some stuff to Class of 79, and this was all online by this stage. Because prior to that, your only option for self-publishing was to literally photocopy it and yourself and try and sell it yourself to someone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was an aspect of it that I didn't really enjoy as much.
What,
the
face-to-face stuff?
Well, the whole kind of... it seemed like an awful lot of work compared to the drawing, which was already an awful lot of work. You know,
right.
It was a lot of work to draw it. And then suddenly you've drawn it, now you've got to go through the process of bundling it up, trying to sell it to someone, and then also trying to get it published. I would say, actually, I think I forgot there, about 95 I did a book for Fantagraphics called Holy Cross and a graphic novel called The Moon Looked Down and Laughed with Mal Coney, who did stuff, who's working in Talisman. I just,
That's
in
a comic
one
shop.
Year, yeah, it was a comic shop. In one year I did, it was about 80 pages, and that kind of, that broke my cherry.
That's pretty
for
significant
long.
To forget.
It's actually 80 pages for the graphic novel and 40 pages for the comic.
So that was paid professional work?
No.
No.
No, it was for Fantagraphics. There was no payment involved.
Right.
But that at that point, because up till then, I'd enjoyed the drawing process, but not the actually sitting your ass down and drawing comics. But then getting back to talking about speed, when I was doing, I did Holy Cross. Davey Francis had done an issue of Holy Cross, Mal said, "Do you want to do a Holy Cross?" I went, "Okay." And this was about 95 or so, and I went, "Okay." And I started drawing it, and at my height, I did about 7 pages per day.
Right.
On some of that. So right. the act of doing
well
it so
working.
Quick. Well, as well as being a student and working, so I was churning out because I didn't have kids.
Now?
It's all. When it's cartoony, it's not bad.
Right.
When it's kind of not cartoony, it's a bit rubbish. But you know. But the thing is, it's 50 pages out. But that
so
kind
get
of
those pages out of the door.
Yeah.
I should go home today and just do stick man.
Yeah.
Like 500 pages.
I guarantee.
I'm an artist.
I guarantee if you sat and did 500 pages of stick man comics, by the end of it, you'll be drawing the best damn stick man that anyone's ever seen.
Fair enough.
So. About 97, I'd already done those things, although they'd taken a long time, so I fancied doing some stuff that was shorter. In order to find friends that are into the same stuff as you, you've got to go and look for them.
Yeah.
And there was nowhere to look. You know, the comic shop, but then you're only going to meet a couple of people. Whereas on the internet, you can go, I'm into 2000 AD, I want to start reading it again. There's a whole group of people there into 2000 AD, and they're going to start reading it.
They were very active, or at least some 2000 AD fans were pretty active early on, and in fact were joined by professionals quite quickly.
Well, in the Alt Comics 2000 AD, which was a news group, which was one of the big things on the internet for a long time, did have a lot of, you know, Andy Diggle was posting in there. Andy was in there. I know there was a lot of other professionals lurking in there. Gordon Rennie was lurking in there. And I kind of got to know some of the people and sent off some stuff to them. And I was going to get work in Mike Sevier's Violent, which is now published by Jay, and the Class of 79. And what happened then was the... doing the small press stuff, Mike Sevier asked me, did I want to do two scripts. One was by some guy whose name I can't remember now, and the other one was by Gordon Rennie, a 2000 AD writer. I went, I'm having that.
For more info about PJ's work, please go to www.pauljholden.com. And for Matt Badham's interviews and writing, please check out his blog at matthewbadham.wordpress.com. All of today's interviews were recorded at Caption, Oxford's Small Press Festival, which is taking place again this weekend, the 6th and 7th of August, at the East Oxford Community Centre, and guests include Al Davison, Ian Culbard, Kate Brown, Paul Rainey, David O'Connell, and Paul Duffield. Tickets are a very reasonable £5 per day, and you can find more info at www.caption.org. If you can't make it to Oxford on Saturday, at Gosh Comics, in their shiny new shop at No. 1 Berwick Street in Soho, Dave McKean is doing a signing of his new graphic novel Celluloid from 2 to 4pm, which also marks the start of an exhibition of his work at the venue. And on the following Saturday, the 13th of August, acclaimed indie comic book artist Luke Pearson will be launching his new title, Everything We Miss, from 6pm. More info about both events can be found at www.goshlondon.com. The weekend after that, Friday the 19th and Saturday the 20th of August, there's a two-day War Comics Festival at the Imperial War Museum in Lambeth. Friday the 19th starts as an academic conference, including presentations by Paul Gravett, Roger Sabin and Tim Pilcher, followed by an hour-long chat on stage by Pat Mills talking about his work. Pat Mills' talk is available as a separate ticket to the conference or included in the price of the whole day. Then on Saturday the 20th, there are a variety of individually ticketed events, including talks by David Collier, author of Chemo, who will also be doing a separate comics-making masterclass, Garth Ennis, who is chatting about his work in a rare UK Comics Festival appearance, and panels including the creators of Dougie's War and War the Human Cost talking about their publications, plus a free film screening at the end of the day. More info about all the above can be found at www.panelborders.com/events. On next week's show, Dick and Harris will be talking to legendary comic salesman and ambassador Mike Lake. And in the meantime, there's an additional internet-exclusive episode of Panel Borders, which includes a longer interview with PJ Holden talking about his art career and breaking into 2000 AD, on my blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Panel Borders was recorded, introduced and edited by Alex Fitch, and we'll be back at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.